You could make a campaign villain around that.
My one weakness, the enemy, the great Lich Bob. I can't defeat him. I must question my own morals and character page, which is just three lines scribbled in crayon because I couldn't find a pen at the moment. No, how dare you, GM, be so cruel.
Everybody, I'm Faith.
I'm Lewis.
And welcome back to Deck of Crotchety Things. This week...
Hello.
God damn it, Lewis.
I knew it threw you off a second time.
I'm trying not to swear in front of my children. Alright, one more time and I swear if you do that again...
I'm not allowed to say hello to the internet. Okay.
You are allowed to say hello to the internet. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me thrice. Chicken soup with rice, I don't know.
That sounds nice.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm Faith.
I'm Lewis.
And welcome back to Deck of Crotchety Things.
Hello to the internet. I was given very specific permission.
Yes.
I was allowed to say hello to the internet. And thus I have said hello to the internet.
Anyway, this week I am going to kind of take over the microphone and read a bunch of my character backstories because I feel like flaunting my writing skills a bit. I know we haven't been terribly active on Twitter lately, but I have thrown out periodically that I do write a book. It's currently like 300, no, it's actually probably closer to 400 pages now. So I also mentioned in a previous episode that D&D provided me a way to flex my writing muscles a bit and refine my style somewhat. So
yeah.
I've got a few backstories. The longest one isn't even a page. The shortest one is like maybe... Hang on. How long is the shortest one? 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs. Yeah.
I do not get to play very often, and I have some of the shortest backstories you'll ever hear.
Yep. So, I'll start with... Actually, hang on. Where is... See if I can find it here. Oh, where is it? My very first one.
I'm actually excited.
Yes, my very first backstory was for a warlock named Tabitha von Splotch. So I gotta pull up that document here. See if I can find it. Oh no, did I lose Tabitha's backstory? I'm gonna be sad if I did. Oh no. Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no. Well. Let's see. Yeah, sorry. This is gonna get edited for sure.
That's fine. I was just looking because I know that you sent me some stuff. Yes, I've got something for Bethag the Breaker.
Oh yeah, B-Tag, yes. She's fun.
Yeah, I think that's it actually I've got. And right next to it I found my Lewis's Mind Flayer episode, which I totally didn't forget about. So we have something in which I have put some work into. Fall back on it some other time.
Oh man, you're supposed to eat the cookie, not drop it on the ground. Right. All right, fine, be that way.
I'm just going to quickly nap something. I'll be back in a second.
That's fine. I'm still trying to find that document. It's supposed to be on this computer. What?
Oh, you actually lost it.
I can't believe I actually lost it.
I'm sure it's just nested somewhere.
Well, I'm doing a whole, like, computer search for it.
Oh.
So far, it's found the... It's found the picture.
I remember my first character from long, long, long ago. I'd never heard of the Dungeons and the Dragons before, at least not more than just in passing. And a friend of mine, who was quite an avid fan of it, said that he'd show me the ropes. And so I went to his house one day and we did a one-on-one session. I, having no idea about any of the tropes or the memes or the themes of the game, I just flicked through the book and just thought, wow, this shit looks cool. And thus was born my tiefling rogue, who was originally a dwarven rogue, but I changed my mind in the last minute, which kind of threw the GM off because he'd planned that I was a dwarf. And so I was now an adopted tiefling to a dwarven father. And honestly, I only remember the session because it was fucking hilarious. It started with the goblins invading the farm that we lived upon. It was a nice country foam farm, because saying two words separately is very difficult, and the word farm and home merged foam.
Foam farm.
So we harvested and traded foams. In our entire house was made of foam, using a particular high-density foam. After the goblins had attacked, they injured my father quite hideously. And so I laid him down in his bed and promised that I would go and help somehow. I don't really remember why, but I never saw him again. And that was my first session. Following that, we then went to the town, where I tried to do some sneaky shit that was totally not part of the plan. And the GM very clearly made it known to me that he had no real plan for me dicking about and just kind of wanted me to learn some stuff. And so, like, it's a tutorial, people. It's a tutorial, railroady, that's fine. So the captain of the watch was an elf with goggles of true strike, true sight, in a small village of about 30 people. The economy was very good where I lived. It was amazing. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I tried to steal a statue out of my own house, but the floorboards were made out of too hard a foam for me to move it. And then I tried to steal some liquor out of my father's cabinet, which he had booby-trapped with a poison dart needle. I don't think my father was very good as a father. But I was a tiefling, so I deserved it. Yep. That was my first character.
That's awesome. Oh, alright, well, I can't seem to find Tabitha von Splodge's story, which makes me sad. So I guess I'll just have to move on to my second character, Martin Greenwald, also known as Martin, the Mighty Sad Barbarian.
The Sadbarian! Sadbarian!
Yes, yes. Martin might not have been the most intelligent man, but that didn't mean he was short on sense. He didn't know how to read, but he was always good at retaining and reiterating stories told to him, and he could reason whether they were true or not. He didn't know what made flowers grow or what clouds were made of, but he reasoned that flowers grew because rain fell from the clouds. One thing he did know, without ever needing to be taught or told, was that he loved his wife Arista. Another thing he knew was that he adored his daughter Lorna. One thing that he and little 4-year-old Lorna learned together was grief, when Arista passed away from a fever that swept through that winter. Grief was a harsh teacher for Martin. During the summer harvest months, when Lorna turned 7, bandits swept through the region, much like the fever that took Arista did. This summer fever took away so much more than just Arista from Martin. This fever burned away his home, the fever burned away his daughter, the fever burned away much of the reason that remained in Martin after Arista's passing. Covered in burns and shedding no tears, Martin dutifully buried the little broken body of Lorna next to her mother. He erected a stone cairn next to his wife's and placed their favorite summer flowers upon them. Wounds still bleeding and skin still cracked from the fires of his ruined life, Martin picked up his harvesting sickle and looked at the wreckage. The fire had been out for days, so had Martin, before he had awakened and buried Lorna. Everything was still on fire for him. His reason, though diminished, wasn't completely gone. He reasoned that since the bandits came from the north, they must have a place there. His village was also to the north a short way. They were repairing a bit of property damage when the people saw Martin. The villagers had proved too troublesome for the bandit raid, which was why they went for Martin's farm. The blacksmith approached Martin as he walked up the main road. "Where are you going?" the smith asked. Martin stopped and looked at him. He looked around the village. "It's all aflame," he rasped. "I'm going to put it out." The smith backed away slowly. When he approached the bandit camp a day later, the fire that the bandits had set in his soul grew hotter than the fire that had desecrated his home. Martin saw only red smoke, felt only heat. Rage gnawed at his heart, and he cut down man after man after man. Stuck with arrows and caked with blood, Martin walked back to the village and collapsed in the square. A few days later, a man from the king stopped in the barber's shop. He stood before Martin's bed and said, "Ye gods, he's actually alive. Well, my good man, you have proven yourself a mighty hero. The king himself recognizes you as a champion of great prowess, and news of your heroism has spread rapidly. There's already songs being sung about Martin the Mighty in the capital. His majesty has asked me to grant you any boon you ask for." Martin turned his head painfully to the barber and gave him a baleful look. He slowly turned his head back to the messenger and rasped in a smoke-choked voice, "I am not a hero. I am not mighty. I'm just a stupid farmer." "So, more land, then?" the messenger asked. Martin shed a tear. "No, I just want Lorna back." So...
That is actually really quite sad.
Yes. Well, it's meant to be.
It very successfully did what it wants to do. I feel kind of sad now.
I liked playing Martin the Mighty Sad Barbarian. When I played him, he actually tag-teamed being the party face in a 5th edition game. The other party face was a very charismatic halfling warlock named Corin Copperkettle. The thing about Corin, though, is that he was, like, way too optimistic and, like, always saw the good in people, which is fine and good and stuff, but when you're dealing with matters of war and things of that nature, and especially in the setting that we were playing in, you needed someone like Martin, who, while he had like an 8 intelligence, had a 14 wisdom, so he was like a very reasonable person.
Yeah.
His charisma wasn't bad either. I think he had like a 12 charisma. So, no. But I chose to have I chose to have Martin be a berserk. Berserker subclass, which, you know, naturally people frown upon because it's not optimized, but I'm one of those people that goes for character rather than optimization.
And if you optimize to fun.
Right. I mean, that's just
the only thing you are to optimize for.
Yeah. See, that's how I optimize. I optimize for character, not for damage. He still looks like a truck. One of the things I did for Martin was he was afraid of fire. So when the sorceress or the warlock cast Firebolt, Martin would flinch, and, you know, I would purposely roll at disadvantage because fire is a PTSD trigger for him. At one point, the warlock caused a forest fire, and Martin got lost in his past, and he almost killed our bard.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he just buried his axe right into her clavicle, and she almost died in one hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it was funny because people didn't quite catch on that he was afraid of fire until that happened. So, that was a good time. Martin wound up killing himself, though, in the end, because...
Oh, no.
Yeah, so he went to the Kingdom of the Undead, because we had to go talk to somebody there. I can't even remember what for. It was part of some quest or another. Like, the party came to this farm, and two of the undead people working on the farm were Lorna and Arista. So his, you know, dead daughter and wife. And he refused to stay alive at. He's just like, I can't deal with this anymore. I just can't. I buried them. They're dead. So he wound up, and this threw the DM for a loop. He did not expect this to happen. Like, he's like, okay, we need to, I guess, have a private RP now. So I wound up convincing some old undead dude to give me a length of rope. And because we were on a farm being run by a Death Watcher? You know, the Undead Beholder? That's a Death Watcher, right? Something like that.
There are several. I think you probably mean the Death Lord.
Ah, maybe that. I don't know.
There are several.
Either way, it was being run by an Undead Beholder with a Southern accent. It was hilarious. it was fantastic.
I love that there's like no like common tone to this.
No, absolutely.
Like, you've got this depressed barbarian, and then you've got this Texas beholder.
Yeah, basically. Well, and I'm kind of glossing over the darker aspects of the setting, just for the sake of.
Yeah, it's not really for everyone.
It was definitely a DM versus players campaign. Except I went and fully embraced it, and the DM was not expecting that at all.
So, I mean, that kind of campaign is completely valid.
Yeah.
So long as it's not a surprise.
Right. So Martin wound up hanging himself. He got resurrected right away as an undead, and he chose to stay on the farm with his family. And he's like, I am absolutely... happy with this. I am no longer Martin the Mighty. I am so glad I'm no longer Martin the Mighty, because Martin did not want to be a folk hero. He did not want to have his name sung for such an atrocity that he committed. You know, he just wanted to be a farmer. He just wanted to have his family. But he was so scarred and messed up, he had no choice but to be a hero, and he hated it.
Hmm.
So I even wrote a song. I set it to the
tune. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I set it to the tune of the Nova Scotia Farewell. And
yes, that famous ditty. How does that one go again?
Hang on a second here. Wait. Because this actually is a good segue into. Introducing you to Beatag the Breaker, who was a barbarian as well. I used her to replace Martin because I liked, you know, being a barbarian.
Yeah.
So
who doesn't?
I know. She was a totem barbarian. Her totem animal was the honey badger. I worked with the DM to make it slightly less broken. There were some things about it that we just needed to tweak, but it wasn't much. So I will read Beat Hag's story, and then I'll sing the song that I wrote for Martin. Because that was actually one of the ways she introduced herself. So, Beat Hag the Breaker. Beat Hag Cormac's daughter was a rambunctious girl. She took after her father in many ways. It's in too many ways. She was built sturdily like her father, drank like her father, cursed like her father. When she was 12, she proved that she was a ruthless hunter and killer like her father. A crag cat that was picking off sheep was her victim. She slipped away from her mother's overprotective gaze and tracked the wretched beast down. Vitek struggled against the monstrous feline and broke its skull upon the stone walls of its den. Bloody and torn, she dragged the carcass down the mountain, breaking it even more. She laid it before her father, the tribe elder. As her mother willed, he'll never marry looking like that. Beathag turned her clawed face to her mother and said, I don't care. I'll do as I like, and I'll take who I please, and I will break the man who defies me. Cormac stroked his beard and chuckled as he regarded Beathag's bloody form. No doubt you would, young Beathag, but I think you're the kind of woman who likes a challenge. You've essentially fulfilled your rite of passage, but you are too young to leave the tribe as yet. Stay with us a few more years, then go find yourself a husband outside the tribe. I don't know that you'll find one to your liking here. As time passed, Beathag's wounds closed into scars. Her chestnut hair grew shiny, her green eyes sharp. Were it not for the scars, she'd look like a lost princess, albeit a tall and broad-shouldered one. Cormac was proud, and the young men still found her beautiful, but terrifying, for all of them had wound up outmatched when they tried to bed her. She tired of such brittle, fearful men and longed for time to speed up so that she could leave. The night of her 19th year, a honey badger came to her in a drunken dream. Thought you didn't care, said lazily. Thought you took what you wanted. I don't care, she snapped, and I do take what I want. Why are you still here then? The badger yawned. What you want is out there. Go take it. Beathag woke in a cold sweat. The tribe law said she wasn't supposed to leave for 2 more years. She didn't care. She took what she wanted. Cormac's giant sword and her mother's turquoise necklace. She left to go take herself a worthy husband.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, she was a very shallow character. I played her very shallowly. She put the bard trope to shame. Let's just put it that way. So, horny barb. She was quite the antagonizer. The bard that Martin almost killed had an NPC boyfriend, and Beathag took great joy in antagonizing the bard and trying to steal her boyfriend. Just because, like, it started out as, oh, he's attractive, and then it turned into, oh, this is hilarious. I checked with the girl who was playing the bard to see if it was okay that I antagonized her character in this way, or if she wanted me to stop, and she was okay with it because it made for good story. So, yeah.
That's King.
Yeah.
That's King.
Oh my gosh, Raymond. So.
Raymond wants to add it to a podcast.
Yeah. I don't know. Raymond might have been contributing this whole time.
Just a little bit.
Let's see here. Let me see if I can find the...
To contrast your... Oh, sorry, what have you found?
I found the song. But what were you going to say?
No, it's fine. I'll do that after your song.
Okay. So the song is sung to the tune of the Nova Scotia Farewell. Here's to Martin, the mightiest man, slayer of 2 dozen men. With sickle in hand and rage in his heart, those bastards met their rightful land. The scourge swept in from the north. They carried fire and blooded steel. With villainous intent and desire, they murdered towns and plundered stores. But Martin the Mighty said no more. I'll end these foes with my own hands. For from me these rogues took my home and the little daughter I adored. He tracked the bandits to their lair. Martin knew the odds were awful low, but justice guided his hand and his heart, and the 24 rogues lay in their gore. Here's to Martin, the mightiest man, the slayer of 2 dozen men. With sickle in hand and rage in his heart, those bastards met their rightful land.
That's really good.
Thank you. I wrote it on a whim. And that's actually kind of how Beat Hag introduced herself to the party at one point. Or rather, they got to know her better, because she just kind of started tagging along, and they set up camp, and that's what she laid out for them. Literally a day after Martin had died. And everybody yeah. was sad, because everybody liked Martin.
That's pretty good. I've never done a song for a character before, I don't think. But yeah, to contrast your very well thought out, very deep and broad characters, I will share with you the character that I've probably used the most in the last half decade. It is Sir Derek.
Is Sir Derek a cleric?
No, he's a paladin.
Oh, even better.
So Derek is a paladin who venerates the only god worth mentioning in any game, and that is Farlangen. Yes, that Farlangen.
I like Farlangen.
So this god is a completely neutral god. He literally doesn't care. I absolutely love his lore because he's just the most apathetic dude I can imagine. He's all about travel. His portfolio is like horizons, distance, roads, travel, and maybe a couple of other things. He was originally in Greyhawk, but he's currently in, well, he was in 3rd edition. I don't know, I've used him in 5th edition. I don't know whether he actually is in 5th edition or not, but I never know. But I used him for some 5th edition games because I was just dropping in and out. I went to England for a couple of weeks and an old friend of mine was running a game. I was like, oh, I'll turn up for something. I was like, I don't really know 5th edition super well. I don't really care to learn 5th edition super well, and I don't really want to get super invested in a character. So I was just sort of bumbling around thinking about what it was, and I came across this and just thought, this is perfect, because one of the religious parts of being a worshipper of Farlangen is that you go on a great pilgrimage, which to do a great pilgrimage, you have to spend every day for a year just traveling by foot. So no horses, no magic carpets, no carts. And you can't go to the same place twice in a week, I think. So you have to be out doing stuff. And after this year, then you start the crusade. This pilgrimage. This pilgrimage has no end. It just goes until you're there and you feel like you're there. And I just absolutely love the god himself, because he manifests in an avatar and then he walks across the material plane just from horizon to horizon. And then when he's done, he'll just teleport to a different horizon and just do it again, because he's eternal and he likes to travel. That's what he does. But because he is a deity, he does have his own little bubble of heaven. To my mind, it's exactly how the Christian Garden of Eden is. It's got big full trees, heavy with fruit and shade. It's warm. There's a babbling brook, which I think answers any question you give it. But there's nothing there. It's super fucking boring. And I love that. I love that this is like the last place I'd like to spend eternity, having venerated someone who's like, you should go out and meet new people.
I think it almost sounds like it's the kind of place that you'd want to just wander around in forever.
Yeah, but it's like, I think it was a finite size. Like, there was a physical limit to how big this not Garden of Eden was. So it was just like, okay, after like a week you'll be bored. Because God himself isn't in the garden. He's off on the material plane, walking across a river. Because it's just nice. So I absolutely love that. And since I was flying in to, it was two friends groups whilst I was there. They were different friends, different groups. I just thought, it's on it. So he's like the third son of a noble family. So he gets to pretty much do what he wants. He chose to just go out there and feel dirt under his feet, really. It was just an easy character for who sat in the meta very well, because the meta was that I was going to be playing in this one group for a week and then in another group for another. It was like 2 weeks with one group and 2 weeks with the other. And then, yeah, he's now just like this recurring theme character.
So it's funny that you mentioned Farlangen, because that reminded me of an NPC that when I was in the Discord server that we met on, I kind of helped make this NPC that is either blessed and or cursed by Farlangen, depending on how you want to look at it. His name was Glenforth and he's a bard. So he would just be doing anything, like making lunch on the Sword Coast, and, you know, he's just like taking shelter in a ruin, and then all of a sudden he's freezing cold because he's suddenly in Icewind Dale.
Oh, good lord.
What?
Just suddenly in Icewind Dale.
Yes. So we came up some great titles for him. So there's like Glenforth the Traveler, but not by choice. Glenforth the Tired of this goddamned nonsense. Glenforth, I survived multiple trips through the fake crossroads and all I got was this goddamn tunic.
I can't find it now. This really bugs me when I can't find this stuff.
Glenforth the Foot Sore and sick of this crap. His alignment is constantly pissed off. For a long time, he's constantly irritated, but then it becomes his personal mission in life to kill all the guardians of the Fae Crossroads so that he can stop being transported. But then he finds out that druids have been creating, they have this spell called Create Backroads. So now his personal quest is to kill all druids.
I have to do some more lore dive stuff for deities at some point.
Yeah, we should probably touch deities properly.
Yes. Alright, so... the...
Hello, Raymond.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, you're a cute baby, that's for sure. Blah. Yeah, very cute.
Contrary to Raymond's loudness, my next character is very quiet. She was made for a homebrew setting and worshipped a servant of a minor god. If Garen's listening, you know, shout out to you, Garen. I actually really enjoyed this character before she got run off. So, I'm gonna read the story of Aurinia Barraget, servant of Ritari. Aurinia was quiet for a dwarf girl, still very mischievous. As a middle child of 11, she found herself in an interesting spot. Whenever they quarreled, she would listen. The more she listened, the more she learned. Using her knowledge, she would either prank her siblings or blackmail them into doing anything she wanted. Her parents were none the wiser, as they had their own troubles to attend to. Aurinia's father, Tokil, had found himself deep in debt, and it was because of this that Aurinia learned that there was more to gain in helping others with her listening skills. One day when she was 27, she was out with her father in the town. He'd spotted employees of the man he owed money to, and he bid Aurinia hide nearby. She listened intently to the conversation. Up till now, she had no idea that her father owed well over 5,000 gold to the local casino. She slipped away unnoticed and followed the men after they'd threatened to kill her father. Cindy Capper's letter to a fine house. Stealthily as she could, she shimmied up a trellis and managed to squeeze into an alcove next to a large window. So unseen, she listened. This particular day, she learned that her father wasn't the only person to owe a hefty sum. She shimmied back down and walked home, but not before she bought something sweet to eat. Her father, who had been worried sick, asked her where she'd been. "I hid really well, Papa," she said, "and then I bought myself a treat because you couldn't find me." Tokil shrugged and went back to worrying about his debt. Aurinia ventured into town on her own. She hid in the alcove by the window every day for a month. She learned, among other things, the most important bit of information. The head of the casino was actively teaching his employees to cheat the patrons into debt. A smile crept over her lips, and Aurinia formed a plan. Instead of buying a treat, she bought parchment and quills. Through her listenings, she'd learned the many places the owner liked to frequent and when he'd be there. She left notes everywhere for him. Nothing terribly threatening, but worded in such ways as the man would be very ill at ease. After 2 weeks of leaving notes, Aurinia hid in her own little alcove again. The owner was very nervous. He paced about, wondering loudly who in the world knew so much about him and how they found it out. The time has come, Aurinia grinned to herself. Time for the killing blow. That night, she wrote the most threatening note she'd ever concocted and made her way to the owner's home. She knew the schedules of the casino owner's guards based off their complaints about the shift changes. When the coast was clear, Aurinia tied the note to a heavy stone and lobbed it through the owner's window. She held her breath and kept very still. The foolish man had never bothered to get hounds, so the chances of anyone finding her were very slim. When the commotion died down, the sobbing began. Aurinia proudly slipped away into the night. The very next morning, Tokil answered the door at breakfast. One of the kneecappers was there with a bag of money and
note of apology from the casino's owner. Seeing how relieved her parents were made Irenia realize that listening was a powerful weapon when used for the right reasons. She waited a few weeks, apologized to all of her siblings, and then asked her parents' permission to join the ranks of the clerics of Ritari, the listener. They raised their eyebrows, but they didn't raise a fuss, and that suited Irenia just fine.
You just have all of these going for you.
Yes.
They're all just really good.
So, Irenia was a fun character. She was a very, to-the-point character in the campaign. She didn't really take crap from anyone. She lasted a session. Because the party leader did not like her. So, as soon as she was able, she scarpered off. Because the party leader was, like, a Goliath paladin, and he threatened her life repeatedly. Like, you know, picked her up by her neck, kind of, and, like, threw her around. So she's just like, okay, well, this guy's psychotic, and I'm leaving. Yeah, so that was fun. She was very short-lived, but she was fun. Because she took a couple levels in Rogue. The character I had to replace her was an actual Rogue, Dorska the Free and Clanless. She was fun. She lasted a couple of sessions. But I don't know if anyone can hear in the background the little loudmouth back there. It makes playing D&D pretty hard, so. I felt that Dorska would be a better fit for the party, so I'm going to tell her story now. It's only a few paragraphs long, so it'll be a little bit quick. Oh, and just as a little bit of background, a couple of the other characters that are mentioned in this backstory were recurring villains in the campaign, so that's how we were able to. Dorska the Free and Clanless. Dorska had always been a sickly yet stubborn girl. On more than one occasion, her parents had left her to die, but somehow she always found a way to keep on living. Runty and malnourished, she was always pushed around by the other children. With bitter stubbornness as cold as the winter wind instilled in her at an early age toward family and peers, she began playing malicious pranks. She was often unnoticed and stole things from one child and placed it in the tent of another, and always strife would ensue. As she grew older, her bitterness ripened. When she came of age, her bitterness began to rot and fester in her heart. While small and frail-looking, her fierce spirit caught the attention of Hoof Liontooth. He loudly declared that while she may not look like she would survive childbirth, any child she would beget with him would certainly would. Her parents gladly married her to him, happy that she was now Liontooth's problem. Dorska's wedding night was not a pleasant one. Hoof Liontooth wasn't gentle. She tried to find some sympathy in Liontooth's other wife, Ursula, but there was none. Ursula was quiet, demure, and had no spirit in her. After 2 years, she stole away in the dead of night. She made for the southern border, and once she felt safe, she took a hot brand to her bridal tattoo and marred it. The symbolism of the blood of the boar is still visible so that people know where she came from, but Dorska calls herself Free and Clanless, and her true names are behind her in the north. Since her departure, she's taken more than a few of Liontooth's hunters down. She prays to Rooney, who has thus kept her alive so far, for the day she can stop looking over her shoulder.
Sorry, I'm drinking.
That's fine. So, Dorska is a Goliath rogue. Now, if anyone familiar with 5th edition knows that Goliath are gigantic people that live in the mountains.
Yep.
Dorska is a runt. She's 6 feet tall, and she is insanely stealthy. So, she was actually a much better fit to the party. At least until the party leader, who had a serious case of main character syndrome, decided to kill her in a dream state adventure. So she left after that. She lasted 3 sessions. So some of these characters did not get very much runtime, which is unfortunate. I think the last one is Saskar Bywater, yes. And Saskar Bywater is named after a character in the novel that I'm writing, and he's not far removed from the original character. I'll read a story, talk a little bit about the campaign, and I think we could probably wrap things up after that. Do you have any more stories?
I don't have any more character backstories, really.
Okay.
As I say, I don't have a lot of play time nowadays.
Yeah.
I am I'm a meta perma GM. Basically, I can never really find a group where I can just play. I joined a group here in Germany. I was like, I turned up and I was like, I'm looking for something new. I'm looking for Shadowrun. And this group like, we play Shadowrun. You can come and play. And I went and played, and I spoke very little German at the time. And no, that's unfair. I spoke quite a bit of German. However, even when you're fluent, there are some words involving cybernetic subdermal implantation of computation devices that just, they don't fall into your normal dictionary. And this is going on at the same time as the troll mage is using levitate to throw the drone out of a window to distract the fire spirit, which is currently working as a guard for the megacorp. Now, that's an entirely normal thing to happen in Shadowrun.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, not entirely normal, but it's within the realms of possibility. But having to learn just that extra level of complexity to the language made it very difficult. And only after a couple of sessions, the GM was saying, if you want to run, we can do a rotation thing. And I was like, I would like to try running something. And I just wanted to do like a run, really. Which a run is it's like a mini quest, really. It's not like D&D per se, where there's like a big quest. Your big quest is your poor ass makes it to next month. And to do this, you take little side jobs or big side jobs. Bigger jobs, bigger money, but more risk, more reward. So you can absolutely make two or three little runs where you just work as an armed guard or work as a bouncer for your mate down the road at the nightclub without, you know, putting on the books. But there's no money in that. The real money is hijacking a police helicopter, repainting it because it's the same chassis model as the private security helicopters that they use for the Cedar Krupp firm, which is run by a dragon, by the way. And then you can take this helicopter to go and land inside the compound to then infiltrate the... I'm making this all up as I go. Infiltrate the caravan of the prototype new tech being delivered from this base to the next base. And, you know, you can get in there. You have to get the right truck because there's like three plus the patrol vehicles. And then halfway down the highway, then you get into a chase as you try to break away from all these guys. And there's a lot of bullets. You're very likely to die. But if you don't, you get paid big, big bucks. And you could probably retire at that point. It's very, very mad. And I was just like, I could really do something. I'd really like to get to hand of it because I didn't understand how certain bits of it worked, because again, unlike D&D just has like this one thing. If you imagine D&D as like a rope, right, the rope has only a few strands in it, so it's more like a twine or a string. But one of these is magic, and one of these is combat, and one of these is social, and these are all plaited off into a string, right? And that's kind of how you could do D&D, right? That kind of makes sense, Faith?
Yep, makes perfect sense to me.
Good, because I sounded like an absolute madman in my own head. Shadowrun is actually like three different ropes. You've got the main stuff, like everything exists on the real in the real world, and you've got your guns and your swords, and you're running and you're driving. But then there's a spirit world, which is parallel and overlapping with the martial world. And this is essentially the ethereal plane. It's not a whole plane. It's just like a veil that you can reach beyond and pull magical energy out to cast spells or to summon a spirit from and have the spirit do something or to banish another spirit into it. But some mages can detach their spirit mind from their body, and their body goes comatose and limp, but they're able to fly around in this overlapping space. They cannot be seen by normal people, but they are flying in the three-dimensional space as essentially a ghost. And whilst they're doing this, they're having epic sword fights with other mages doing the same thing. So next time you're on a bus and it's just really boring, just imagine that somewhere between you, there are actually two wizard ghosts having an epic sword fight, because fuck you.
That's awesome.
At the same time, there is the overlapping world of the internet, known as the Matrix, where everything is connected, and the Decker and the Rigger are doing their own stuff. The Decker is hacking into stuff to jam the enemy's gun, or to turn the lights off on their side of the room, so that they're in darkness and the other side is still in light, or overriding the door security on the other side of the room so that the guards can't come through it anymore to reinforce the group that they're in. And at the same time, they're jamming the camera feed and doing a loop of an empty room or something. And then at the same time, they've sent a parcel of data to another section of the compound to trigger an alarm over on that side of the compound. So everyone's going over that side now, and they're juggling all this stuff up in the air. They're not really doing anything in the physical space, because they can be, but also, like the wizard, they can go comatose, but they're not going into the astral world. They're going into the Matrix. And it's exactly like the movie, which came out considerably later, I believe. Yes, considerably later, where your body then goes comatose and you're now living in a designed digital world that looks and feels real, but it's also pretty extra. The Rigger is also going comatose, so that he can put his mind into a drone somewhere. So he's doing stuff via the Matrix to go back into the physical world as the drone. And you've just got the troll Street Sam, who is just the big tough guy of the party. And he's firing his little machine gun from behind cover. And he just looks around and he's just like, why do they always take a nap in the firefight? And everyone is off doing stuff. And it was very, very difficult for me to just step onto that ledge. It's a big step up in complexity. Not difficulty, but complexity. There was just so many different things to go on. And I thought, yeah, I'd like to do this, do a short mini campaign. We can do one run and we'll see how it goes. I ended up running forever. The guy who was supposed to take the rotation after me just left the group.
Oh, wow.
And no one else really felt like it, so I was just like, well, shit. Guess I'm now running a German game. And pretty much every game was just sort of like, yeah, so da steht sein Drohnen auf der Straße und Googles, what is this word? Es schießt dich mit der AK-97. And it was just effort. I ended up having to leave that group because it was just too much work for me.
Yeah.
But I have since deliberately run a lot of Shadowrun 5th edition. And that game is absolute perfection for me. I love it. It is a game that someone built for me. I swear to God. It is really technical. There's lots of stuff going on. Some of it is hilariously badly worded. And some of it is just not well explained. So at times it's a bit of a challenge to get through. I am really overselling the errors here. It's absolutely grand. I do recommend anyone who hasn't try it. The current edition is Shadowrun 6th, but I don't know much about it, I'm afraid. Because, yeah, we just like Shadowrun 5th, honestly. I'm sure there's an edition war going on somewhere, but I can't really see anyone who really cares. Basically, last I saw, there was a group of people who were like, oh, I really like 6. I'm going to start playing 6. And there's a group of people who was like, eh, have fun. And that was it. It was fascinating. But yeah, so, and then I wanted to play Pathfinder, but the only people who'd play wanted me to be GM.
Naturally.
I do really enjoy being a GM, but...
I was going to say, if you weren't so damn good at telling stories and stuff...
I mean, I did just ramble about the time a German
just
group...
Just saying!
Yeah, no, I'm actually playing in quite a few games at the moment, to be honest. We just wrapped up a third edition Skip Williams campaign.
Nice.
Run by a friend of mine. I really enjoyed it. It was really good fun. Also playing in a Shadowrun 5th and a Traveler game. Traveler 2nd edition Mongoose edition game. Though those are incredibly infrequent, but I really love the systems. I'm very quickly finding so many reasons to find other games. No, right. Cut that bit. Oh,
okay.
We are a 3rd edition group. We talk about how great 3rd edition is. But yeah, 3rd edition is absolutely fantastic.
Yes. Unfortunately, all my backstories today are 5th edition characters, but what you gonna do?
The backstory isn't mechanical.
I know.
Also, when I start talking, I forget to stop, and then I end up with like a 5-page backstory, and then I try to condense it down to like 3 sentences, but then I get distracted and end up doing like 5 pages instead, and now I've got 8 pages that no one's going to read, not even myself. So then I just come up with an entirely new character, and it's like, yeah, this is Bob the Fighter. He fights things, preferably things that aren't called Bob.
Bob the Fighter who fights things that aren't called Bob. Well, that's a lot of things.
Hmm.
You could make a campaign villain around that.
My one weakness! The enemy! The great lich, Bob! I can't defeat him! I must question my own morals and character page, which is just 3 lines scribbled in crayon because I couldn't find a pen at the moment. No! How dare you, GM, be so cruel as to make me think about choices?
Just enter a kingdom and everyone, male or female, is a derivative of Robert or Roberta or anything of that nature. And you can't attack them. You'd be attacking a Bob.
And this is why Faith is banned from GMing.
Yes. Well, I mean, my brother came up with these, I think he based them off of ochre jellies. But he gave them one eye, and all of them were named Mo. And they weren't really evil or anything. They were just there. And the one thing I remember is that, like, his friends... Because he was DMing at the time. So the party made up of his friends, like, they showed up, and they were... They killed this monster, they freed the king of the Moes, and he invited them to stay at the motel. And that's all I remember. So maybe everyone in my family should be banned from GMing. Just because of the puns. I don't know.
No.
Anyway.
Puns are important. You can't go without puns. You woke up and the first thing you did today was engage in a pun battle with me.
No, that was yesterday, Lewis.
Okay, this...
Yeah,
Time dragons!
Yes, definitely time dragons. Definitely the time dragons. The clock newts.
I forgot what I called them now. I'm sure it was rude.
You said that they were...
Oh, yes.
Capable of reptile disjunction. And then it turned into a bunch of dick puns. And then we went from dick puns right into oceanic nautical puns, which I don't know anyone else I'd be able to do that kind of nonsense with.
No, it honestly just came from nowhere and went nowhere, and it was the best thing I did all day.
Yeah. I mean, pun trains, man. So, wrap this up with the backstory of Saskar Bywater. Saskar Bywater rubbed his temples and furrowed his bushy eyebrows. Retirement can't come soon enough, he thought grouchily. It's going to be Maritha's birthday in a few months. I'll actually be home for it, and I won't have to come back here afterward. He stretched a little inside. He reached down and rubbed his arthritic knee. It's going to rain tonight, he grumbled in his mind. I hate the rain. Memories of his career floated around his mindscape. Now at age 72, Saskar had been a spy for almost 55 years. He was recruited early because of his small stature, quick reflexes, sharp eyes, and keen mind. As decades passed and the missions were completed, only one of those attributes had changed, and Saskar begrudged his left knee. If it it been my eyes, he rumbled internally, I could have retired a long time ago, but no, it just had to be my god's damned knee. They could still use me if I can see. A knock, a curt granting of permission, a letter on the desk. A short, meaningless exchange with the courier, a departure. Saskar stared at the seal and recognized it as belonging to his old handler, Geralt. He audibly growled at the parchment. Oh, I know what you are, he hissed at the document. You're a kink in my retirement plan. I didn't get moved to the Royal Guard to sit around and count the days for nothing, Geralt. I'm old. I'm done. There's nothing you can say that will change that. After several long moments of glowering at the sealed letter, Saskar finally picked it up and broke the seal. He read the contents. Saskar, my old friend, I hope this letter finds you well. No, you don't, you old bastard. I have unfortunate news for you, though, regarding your retirement. I already knew that. Her Majesty the Queen herself has requested that you handle a matter, and should you prove successful, you are to be rewarded handsomely with a villa in the Nobles' District. Fuck, I don't need a villa in this city. That said, your retirement date is pushed back until the mission is completed. Fuck, I knew it! I hate you, Geralt! There's a spy in the Royal Guard. The infiltrator needs to be found, without incident. If this mole catches on that they're being hunted, they will disappear and we'll be back where we began. You all knew there was a spy in here, and that's why you transferred me. Be on your guard, Saskar. You're the only man Her Majesty trusts for this job. And with good reason. Your blunders are few and far between, but this eel is a slippery one. Even if you weren't already stationed in the Royal Guard, you would still be assigned this task. Best of luck to you, old bird. Geralt. Saskar sighed and dropped the letter. I'm sorry, Maritha, he thought glumly. I'm sorry I'm too good at my job. Looks like I'll be missing that party after all.
Aww. So,
yeah. Sucks to be Saskar. So, this was a homebrew campaign character. Saskar was basically designated from the get-go, shockingly, to everybody in the room, in the party, really. He was just designated party leader. I didn't ask for that. I didn't want it. And it put me on the spot something fierce. He was a fun character. He was like a 7th level rogue and a 3rd level bard or something like that. I don't know. And I made dexterity my dump stat, which, you know, you don't do when you're a rogue, but you do if you're Saskar and you have a bad knee. Everybody liked Saskar, and nobody seemed to resent me being in charge of the mission, being party leader. I did not like it at all. But I did the very best I could to make sure that everyone got screen time, basically.
Yeah.
So it's hard when the DM just kind of throws at you, Saskar is in charge of everything now. And I'm just like, what? What? I wound up having to leave that campaign because Raymond.
But,
yeah. It just got to be, like, because it was an intrigue mystery campaign, and it required a lot of note-taking, which normally I'm very good at, but it's hard to take notes when you're juggling a baby.
It is. I've heard this.
Yes. So I just could not put in the attention necessary to play this campaign and you know, useful. It was fun, though. We had an Arakocra in the party who was, he had, like, the mentality of a 5-year-old. And, like, all the reasoning of a 5-year-old. He was hilarious. The guy who played him roleplayed him so well. So, no. It was, I do kind of miss that campaign, but at the same time, it's like, it's not fun being in charge. That's why I don't want to be in charge.
Yeah.
That's too much pressure, man. Too much pressure. That wraps up Faith's backstories for 5th edition. I'm sad that I can't find Tabitha von Splotch's backstory. Hers was very fun. It was almost musically written. But y'all got to hear Martin the Mighty, so I guess it balances out. So, anything you want to add?
No, just that all backstories are valid. I've really enjoyed listening to the heart and soul you've put into your characters. So I definitely haven't put heart and soul into mine, comparatively. But yeah, this, I don't think there's a bad method to character backstories.
So I was just thinking, I've talked to a lot of people, and there's always... Like, I do think some methods of backstory writing are better than others. I personally ascribe to the method of really your backstory should contain, like, a quick overview of your character's personality, which you can bring out through dialogue or through action. But the core of your backstory should be what put them on the path of adventuring in the first place. What is the defining event? So for Martin, it was the death of his daughter and killing those guys. For Beat Hag, it was having a dream. Dorska was just escaping her abusive husband. Saskar getting a letter in the mail. You know, it's just like, I don't think you need to go into lineage too much, which I've definitely read some backstories where, you know, they go on and on for ages about lineage, but there's really not a whole lot of soul there, just as like the lineage is all there is to that person. And sometimes that's the case. Some people only live off of their family name, but I feel like you can define that more succinctly.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, that's just me. Like, you know, there's no wrong way to do it. But there are some methods that, in my opinion, are better than others, which is why I did my very best to shrink everything down from, wow, this guy's got a really storied history because, you know, he's been a spy for 55 years to, like, a page.
Yeah.
You just needed to know that he was successful at what he did. So.
Yeah. And I can only really speak as a GM, because that's where the majority of my experience on this comes. If you come to my table with a backstory, that's great. If you have a 3-line backstory or a 3-paragraph backstory, that's all fine. If it's 14 pages, I'm not reading that. Like, there might be some sort of system where that is a reasonable amount of backstory, but I can't see any reason offhand why I would want to read that. You can actually have a backstory like that, and I would recommend that if you do end up going overboard and having this really, really deep and long backstory, that you also have an abridged version for the GM. Also, that you're not asking definitely. For stuff. Don't be begging for stuff through a backstory. That's not super cool. Like, oh, I was in the forest and I found this holy venger just sticking in a stone, and I pulled it out of the stone and became king of the land. And it's like you're playing a level 1 game, right? You're not the king, and you don't have a holy avenger. I'm sorry.
Backstory should be an introduction of how you are going to play your character. It should not be a means to getting free stuff.
Yeah.
If the GM looks at your backstory and says, oh, I like the way this character is written, I like how this character is played, I think we should take an element of your backstory and give you a plot hook to get a sweet item.
Yeah.
That is what backstory should be used for.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So those are our controversial opinions on backstory. So I think we'll, I can't think of anything else.
No, I think we've rounded that off. Yeah, don't beg. Don't assume that we will read. And as a GM, if you're a newer GM and someone does come up to you with a 16-page backstory or even a 3-page backstory, don't feel bad about saying, no, this is too much. It's completely valid and fair. Also, it depends on the campaign you're running. If I was running a level 15 to level 20 campaign, right? You've got 15 levels to have a backstory in, and that can be a really cool thing. Like, just think about what feasibly a level 1 to 15 character can get through. Like, that's a whole adventure where you've killed a lich. Maybe that's your backstory. You killed a lich. Super. Maybe it's not permanently dead, and you've got this recurring villain from your backstory who is a lich. That's super cool. But if you're level 1, you're not finding a holy venger in the woods that makes you the king of not England. And I had a point, but then I rambled. And then I went back to Sword and Stone. Yeah, if you're doing one-shots and pre-gens, right? This is one that actually bugs me a lot. Sorry. When you're doing a one-shot with someone, and maybe that one-shot lasts 3 sessions or whatnot, but it's supposed to be a one-shot. And I have sat in one-shots that were one-shots, and there has been a player who will have more backstory than the time we actually play. And it's just for a one-shot. That character is then thrown up in. Like, no one sees it again. It might be important to them, and you can have your little backstory, but like the way he was presenting it, he was like just going on and on and on about this one character. For the one shot was for someone to learn how combat works as the GM. So the one shot concept was, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of combat, and I'm going to see how combat works. And so we didn't need the 4-page backstory for a character for that. It was just build a thing so we can see how combat works.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, you don't need that much backstory. Even in a campaign, it's almost like, you know what? I had a thought and it died. So, yeah. So yeah, I guess we'll wrap it up here. Anyway, I hope you all enjoyed Faith's mic time.
I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed not having to ramble on.
I'll try to do more of these types of things, you know, as I'm able. And you know, we'll catch you. You next time.
I'd
so
love that.
So until then,
have fun. Keep adventuring.
Heck yeah. Bye, everybody.
Ciao.
Special thanks to Tom from Tabletop Audio, David Veslian, and Kumi Tanyoka for the music in this episode, and to Chris for our sweet art. And an extra special thanks to you, dear listeners, for your continued support. Hit us up on Twitter @GrumpyDuck or hop into our Discord. The link is in our pinned tweet. We'll catch you next time!